Right. So for the sake of those who record and edit and post these talks, I'll call this one Every Day is a Good Day. So this is based on a koan from the Blue Cliff Record. So the main case, Uman addressed the assembly and said, I am not asking you about the days before the 15th of the month, but what about after the 15th? Come and give me a word about those days. So the explanation of this is kind of, the 15th is just kind of an arbitrary date. It just means kind of like before. I'm not talking about before. I'm talking about kind of now. Give me a word about those days. And he himself gave the answer for them. Every day is a good day. So what is a good day? I think for each of ourselves, we could come up with quite a few different answers for that. I mean, at the very kind of surface level, a good day is one where we experience good fortune. We're in a good mood. We feel kind of happy, you know, lucky to be alive, whatever. But we also know that when we start to evaluate, you know, is this a good day? When come tomorrow, is that a good day? You know, it can become more complex. If it's a good day for me, I have good fortune. But there are, you know, is it a good day for the people in Gaza? And how can I have a good day while there are beings who are suffering? You know, what is good? If we use, you know, judge good in a worldly sense, in terms of fortune and happiness and this and that, it's a kind of ephemeral and kind of arbitrary and relative designation. It's kind of if it's just sentimental. And some of us are pretty happy in our lives. Others, not so much. Whether it is because of the circumstances of our lives or just for some reason, that's the way that our mind and heart are aligning right now, that it doesn't feel like a good day. But they're telling us every day is a good day. So one of the things that we do in Buddhism, including Zen, is to try to challenge and strip away our preconceived ideas. So the original Buddhist monks, and maybe they still do this, but you know, the Buddha would have them reduce their attachment to the body and their identification with the body by having them meditate in charnel grounds, where bodies were being burned and, you know, dead bodies were decomposing. So they'd kind of sit there and be as this visceral reminder of the impermanence of the body. And, you know, even if you have health and beauty now, well, eventually you won't. And, you know, so it's like, and they had other meditations, you know, is yourself in your hair? Is it in your fingernails? Where is this self? And it would deconstruct this idea of the self that we carry around. I like to think that kind of we have some modern versions of this kind of deconstructive meditation. And one of my favorites is to read about evolutionary psychology and, like, you know, current research and how our minds work. And so this is something from that I just discovered from the happiness hypothesis by Jonathan Haidt. So he was talking about how in psychology, social psychology, and just general psychology, I guess, for a long time, it was viewed that, you know, your personality, your frame of mind, everything was largely dependent on your upbringing and your parent, what you experienced as a child and what your parents did to you and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, nature was a tiny part and nurture was most of it. But that then they started doing studies, particularly on identical twins, particularly identical twins who were separated at birth. And then it really gave us a different picture. So now it looks like, you know, nature, your genes have a lot to do with like all kinds of aspects of your personality, of your preferences, of your state of mind, everything. So this is from the book. A person's average or typical level of happiness, that is that person's affective style. So affect referring to the felt or experienced part of emotion. Your affective style reflects the everyday balance of power between your approach system and your withdrawal system. So this is kind of the evolutionary part, right? Like we have kind of attraction toward things that might be advantageous or positive or good. And the withdrawal, like that's dangerous, that might be bad. And what they've shown, like this is evolutionary theory, but they've also illustrated it through research. Our withdrawal systems are generally a lot stronger than our approach systems. And this makes sense from an evolutionary perspective because if there's a positive mate, that might be some good food to eat. It's not necessary that like you get, you know, just drawn to that thing immediately. But if there's something threatening, you know, there's a snake that might bite you, you have to have a strong, you know, withdrawal system. So there's your affective style is reflected on this balance between the approach system and your withdrawal system. And this balance can be read right from your forehead. It has long been known from studies of brainwaves that most people show an asymmetry, more activity either in the right frontal cortex or in the left frontal cortex. In the late 1980s, Richard Davidson at the University of Wisconsin discovered that these asymmetries correlated with a person's general tendencies to experience positive and negative emotions. People showing more of a certain kind of brainwave coming from the left side of the forehead reported feeling more happiness in their daily lives and less fear, anxiety, and shame than people exhibiting higher activity on the right side. Later research showed that these cortical lefties are less subject to depression and recover more quickly from negative experiences. The difference between cortical righties and lefties can be seen even in infants. 10-month-old babies showing more activity on the right side are more likely to cry when separated briefly from their mothers. And this difference in infancy appears to reflect on an aspect of personality that is stable for most people all the way through adulthood. Babies who show a lot more activity on the right side of the forehead become toddlers who are more anxious about novel situations. As teenagers, they are more likely to be fearful about dating and social activities. And finally, as adults, they are more likely to need psychotherapy to loosen up. Having lost out in the cortical lottery, they will struggle all their lives to weaken the grip of an overactive withdrawal system. Once when a friend of mine with a negative affective style was bemoaning her life situation, someone suggested that a move to a different city would suit her. Well, no, she said, I can be unhappy anywhere. So, Yes, this is the Happiness Hypothesis is the book. So, you know, hearing this, if you, yeah, Jonathan Haidt, hearing this, you may find it sobering or encouraging or discouraging or humbling. I mean, I feel like, well, one of the things he does say elsewhere is that there are three things that can change your brain, and that is meditation. So he's a big fan of meditation, cognitive therapy, and SSRIs, the medication. And he said that the medication is just like, it's as long as you're on it, whereas the other two can actually make a lasting change. So it's not, you know, we shouldn't despair. But it is, I think this is a useful thing to contemplate. Not that we have to necessarily just believe it all, right? But to even contemplate, because it can challenge our ideas of ourselves. I can be proud of my positive outlook, you know? And it's because I've done all this spiritual practice. And like, maybe it's kind of just the way my brain is wired. Or maybe someone else, their brain is wired in a different way. And, you know, no matter what, they kind of just have to struggle with that, you know, negative affect. So what Haidt says the meditation and cognitive therapy do is they change the elephant. So he likes to use this metaphor. Like he finds that it's when communicating these kinds of ideas, it's helpful to have some kind of metaphor. And the metaphor for our being that he's come up with, you know, the Buddha came up with, like, you know, we have the five skandhas and all that. So Haidt thinks of it as a rider on an elephant, and the rider is our conscious, verbal, you know, aspect of ourselves. And the elephant is everything else. The elephant is like the body, it's physical things, it's all of these responses that happen even before we're conscious of them. There's proven how often, like, the conscious part of ourselves is just, it's in on after the fact, right? Like, this is all, we're already, elephant's already going down this road, and the rider's like, well, we wanted to go over here, and explains to other people why that's a rational thing, or you know, making a case for what the elephant is actually doing. Or the rider, as we know, the rider can be up there going like, no, don't do that. And the elephant just does it anyway. So Haidt talks about meditation and cognitive therapy work because they're working on the elephant, right? As opposed to trying to, like, strengthen the rider and, like, you know, make the rider more, you know, to be able to discipline that elephant. So I was thinking about that in terms of, it's kind of given me a new way to think about our Zazen, is that when we're sitting, we're like, we're telling the rider, like, okay, the elephant's just going to sit here. Okay. So everything's okay. So you can just let go. You can just chill out. We don't need anything from you, right? Just letting the rider be quiet, be still. And then we get more in touch with something deeper. I mean, who knows? There's something mysterious happens when we're sitting there. So happiness versus depression or despair or overwhelm. I'm guessing that most of you will find these things creeping up at times. You know, how much time you spend in a negative state, you know, who knows, probably changes over time, depends on what's going on, depends on who you are. But I feel like, at least in this point in my life, I've pretty positive aspect, you know, pretty like, even when I see awful things in the world, like I have a big perspective. Like, but even so, I don't know. It's like, sometimes it's just a shift in the weather, or maybe it's what I ate. I don't know. Sometimes things just seem shittier. And, you know, kind of like, for the way that it manifests for me often is just a sense of like, how did I end up with so much shit to do? And like, there's no way out from underneath it. Like, it's just an endless, you know, getting through the shit, and there's no rest. Like, as soon as you get to the end of it, there's more shit to do. You know, and I just can get into that sense of where, here, I'm aspiring to live as if every day is a good day. And I'll be like, well, not today. The to-do list is too long, right? Tomorrow might be a good day or whatever. So there's many, one of the points that Haidt makes in his book, which I'm not done with yet. So he characterizes, if you end up reading it, he characterizes Buddhism kind of a, well, I've got some arguments with him. I mean, it's too shallow. He's not a Zen, he's not a Buddhist teacher, right? And he kind of takes the extreme versions of what, you know, the Buddha taught of basically, it's kind of like mind over matter, right? Like you can, your happiness depends entirely on the state of your mind. And so if you just, you know, meditate and do these things, then you don't need, it doesn't matter what's happening. And Haidt points out, you know, it does matter what's happening. If you have good human relationships, you are happier. You know, if you have the support of a community, if you, in general, if people are part of a religious community, they are happier on average. Like, there are things that really do matter to our happiness. And I don't think Buddhism denies that, right? Like, that's what we have. That's what we have teachers for, is to, okay, yeah, the teachings say that. And we take care of ourselves and we take care of our lives. But in terms of our practice, when we find kind of depression, despair, overwhelm creeping up, it'd be very interesting to ask ourselves, how much zazen are we sitting? And if we are sitting, how much are we giving ourselves over to zazen? Right? I think the inclination, you know, sometimes people come talk to me and they, you know, it's like, oh man, things are difficult and confusing and whatever. And like, I haven't had any chance to sit. And like, it's like, and, you know, like that is our main practice, but maybe it's something that we don't turn to because it's not an obvious, like, it's going to solve our problems or address. It's not going to make my to-do list shorter. You know, I don't have time to sit. And yet that sitting does something different to us, right? So in this, the commentary on this koan, Every Day is a Good Day, this is from two Zen classics, by translated and with commentaries by Katsuki Sekida. So in his commentary, he gets into this, most of his commentaries are kind of short, but he goes way into this, the teaching of the three nens. So I'll share some of what he says and then discuss how it relates. So he's commenting on a verse of a poem that's associated with this koan. Watching at leisure, you retain the tracks of flying birds. So Sekida says, flying birds leave no tracks. Yet in positive samadhi, Well, that's the, you know, the stillness of mind. You see them clearly, as if you are watching a slow motion film. In other words, when the first Nen recovers its inherently clear and vivid activity, so he explains Nen later, but Nen means like it's a way of dividing up the different functions of mind. So the first Nen is just like sensory perception. In other words, when the first Nen recovers its inherently clear and vivid activity, the present moment becomes rich in content. Just as a dying man in his last moments sees scenes of his whole life, or as a musician who hears far more in a piece of music than an ordinary listener, then we can virtually catch hold of the traces of the flying notes. That's the musician. So he goes on to say, in our zazen, we are returning to that first and then, that direct perception of reality. And I love that description of the present moment becomes rich in content. When we first sit down, our minds are like, you know, boring, nothing's happening. And we, you know, we want to check out. But if we are able to settle, we realize there's nothing boring. Nothing is boring. So reason can make contact with the outside world only indirectly. Direct cognition of the world is achieved through the intuitive action of the first Nen. Putting it in more abstract terms, we may say that the first Nen represents our intuitive, sensory, and perceptive activity, which receives impressions directly from external objects. The second, actually, thoughts are considered to be kind of external objects in a way. They're just things that arise, certain kinds of thoughts. The second Nen reflects upon the first Nen and recognizes it as one's own thought, thus producing self-consciousness and the recognition of one's ego. So the way that my teachers describe this is like first Nen is just, you know, you hear a dog bark, it's just a sound. Second Nen is, that's a dog. You know, I am hearing it. Like it puts labels, basic labels on things. If the first Nen is not reflected upon the second Nen, it is not recognized and not retained in the memory. Our daily life is full of activities, eating, walking, even talking and thinking, which are carelessly or casually done and forgotten. The second Nen too does not reflect upon itself. And again, if it is not reflected upon by another ensuing reflecting action of the mind, it is not recognized. This next coming action may be called the secondary reflecting action, a little complicated. This too does not reflect upon itself, but it can be repeated so that, for instance, we think, I recognize that I was reflecting upon my thought that had been thinking, what a detestable fellow he is. So the third Nen is, you know, it's comments on, you know, second and third Nen. So it's like, now we've, you know, that's my neighbor's dog. That's annoying. Why does my neighbor have to keep, you know, barking his dog? I shouldn't be bothered by that in my zazen anyway. I'm like, you know, my zazen has been getting bad these days. And like, we can cycle around and around and around in the third Nen and not like, we're no longer even tuned in to what's going on around us. So this is one of the ways we could explain why our zazen is important and makes a difference, right? Is for the time being, we're like settling back down into reality. There is one contraindication, though, for zazen. So generally speaking, if we are finding it difficult to feel like today is a good day, sitting more zazen generally helps. However, if you are stuck in depressive or anxious loops, I suppose maybe anger, but basically when you find your mind perseverating on a negative track and sitting with that track, it's like, you know, in theory, oh, you sit, and then eventually the mind will settle down. And you're like, and it's different. It's very different than your mind is wandering. You know, you're thinking about what you're going to do next week, or those kinds of thoughts generally have a lower emotional valence, right? They're not that compelling. They're just maybe annoying, whatever. But sometimes there's a real, like, life is shit, I am shit, and if I sit here, I'm just going to find more reasons why I am shit and life is shit. And, like, it actually hurts, right? In that circumstances, zazen, as we usually do it, is unhelpful and perhaps even damaging. But if you find yourself like that, like, I mean, you might avail yourself of a couple of those other things, like Haidt recommends, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy and or medication that can kind of, you know, jolt you out of the perseveration. And if, you know, we always encourage people to not look at that as like, that is like, now you're failing at practice and you have to go avail yourself of those other things, right? It's all practice. It's like, you do what you need to relieve suffering and to see through delusion. The Buddha did not say you can only use these tools, right? Like, if you're a Buddhist, you have to limit yourself to these tools. Anything, you'd be ridiculous not to avail yourself of whatever helps. So you might try those. And or if you, you know, want to meditate, there are many other forms of meditation. So, you know, maybe something like following your breath, something like that, to kind of just, you know, get out of the loop can help. If it's very, very strong perseveration, something that's probably unlikely to help. So there's, you know, doing walking meditation instead can sometimes help, especially if there's kind of, you know, post-traumatic stress, physical stuff. There are beautiful meditations you can do where you copy sutras. You can do that in terms of, you know, just doing it in English, maybe with a nice pen and paper, or you can even get sutras that are written in kanji and you can try to copy kanji. And you can invite yourself in a similar way. You're asking your rider to rest, right? You're asking your rider to just chill and trying to, you know, embody that elephant instead. And, you know, even guided meditations are something that can, you know, rather than having to kind of be in charge of your own process, somebody can lead you through a process which just allows you to have a break from that. So, let's see. I mean, every day is a good day, is a practice. You know, not an ideal or a yardstick for us to measure ourselves against, right? If you're a good Buddhist, every day would seem like a good day. So if you're feeling stressed or miserable or discouraged or overwhelmed, then you're failing. You know, instead, we're just asked to tune into that mystery, which which really it's, you know, Zazen and mindfulness that allows us to do that. Tune into that mystery where, you know, it's really kind of sad how easily we can miss the preciousness of just this. Right? Like you described it so well, like the, you know, a dying person, this was their last few hours. You just look and see every little quirky thing in our environment, every little sign of care or compassion is just amazing. A cause for immense gratitude. And that's where, like, that every day can be a good day in that sense, even if in a kind of a worldly sense, some days are better than others. So I have a few more things that I can throw in if nobody has anything to say, but I will leave it there for comments and questions. Vince?
Actually, Richie Davidson has done a lot of work on studying meditation with MRI. People from...
Do you want to... Can you come up here so that the cloud people can hear you? Or...
You mentioned Richie Davidson from Wisconsin-Madison. He's done an awful lot of work on meditation. Using fMRI to study, actually, monks who've done 10,000 hours from Tibet and other stuff. He's written a couple of good books, so might be interested. Maybe he's interested. It's hard science, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And there are big changes. And on a personal level, for me, the Zazen and the meditation changes my perspective. And I think it's not a good and a great analogy, but it's sort of like people who want to commit suicide but don't have the means or efficient means, and they get past the time and don't want to do it, they eventually stop committing suicide or stop having the thoughts from suicide. So, oh, one other thing. There's a Japanese movie out called Perfect Days about a guy who cleans toilets.
Yeah, I haven't seen that yet, but it's on my list.
Good.
What's it called?
Perfect Days.
Perfect Days.
And yes, and it is the three Nens, N-E-N-S.
So, yeah. To clarify, the elephant and the rider, are we saying the elephant is going to go where it goes? And the rider?
Well, I think
learns to accept. I mean, because in a certain way, the life does what life does. Like I kind of get the
elephant, but he points out a lot. Like the elephant is not necessarily it's not necessarily great to have the elephant be in charge of everything, okay. Right? Like the elephant can just be, you know, that's where all of our like unconscious biases are and all of that. So he's really looking for like a better relationship between the rider and the elephant, you know, like understanding, like, and I mean, to me, this whole metaphor makes so much sense, right? Because I remember when I first did the term student program, like making vows, like, I mean, it was totally the rider had no sense of the elephant at all. And the rider said, all right, we're going to do this from now on. And then you just find yourself doing the opposite, right? And it's almost like the elephant's like, screw you, you know? And just to constantly be at odds like that. So it's about kind of like getting to know the elephant, getting to know what might kind of make sense to the elephant, and... you know, realizing the limitations of the executive function. And then also, you know, it's really like, it also ties in with like AA and addiction stuff, where, you know, that's the first thing, that I'm not in control. I'm not in control here. And yet that doesn't mean I can't do anything about this, right? It means I have to go about it differently. I can't go about it through sheer force of will, conscious will, but I can restructure my life and I can make sure that I don't have alcohol in the house. And I can make sure that I don't go to bars, and I make sure, you know, like, yeah. Jen, and then Mark.
Just about the elephant and the rider, when I'm looking at it during Zazen, there's so much conflict, like you said, between what the rider wants to do and the elephant wants to do. And I found it important, like when you think of turning the light around, it feels like getting off the elephant and not just like tolerating it, but like that elephant is going to do whatever it's going to do until you pay attention to it. You know, it's going to say, I'm you. Don't pretend I'm not you. And you have to check its feed, and you have to talk to it, and you have to say, thank you for carrying me this far. And where would you like to go? Like, can we talk about this? You know, and I've just, you know, that has been really important for me to realize that the elephant is me, you know, and the rider is me. And then I also wanted to, it was really interesting what you said about the right and left brain, because I never associated the right brain with depression. I associated it with creativity. And I'm definitely right-brained on the whole, and my husband is more left-brained, being an engineer. And I think that the right brain, I could get how that would, I don't know a lot about depression clinically. I have experienced what I feel to be depression and emotions and whatever, but I also think the right brain is, you can experience joy through the right brain also.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a creative person who's experiencing depression, I think leaning into something creative may also help. I feel that it does for me. So anyway.
Thank you. Yeah, when I'm, it's so easy to just fall into a habit and sit down for Zazen and just try to not think, and like just, you know, for the writer to just have this intention for how it's supposed to go, and then for it not to be going that way at all, you know. And then that what generally works best for me is that sense of like including all of it, and then talking to my elephant, being like, you know, we'll get all that stuff done so much better if we just sit right now. Just letting it all go makes us so much more efficient. You know? And there is really part of me that goes like, okay, all right, we'll do that. Mark, did you still want to say something?
Yes, I just took my hand down. I think through Zen, and I've been reading this guy called Damasio, who talks a lot about what your brain and your body does without you being involved. You know, our bodies and our brains are doing tons of stuff without this little mind saying, do this, do that. And also, you know, I grew up in the 20th century, you know, the century of Freud, and then there was the big New Age thing. Mm. And there was this idea that you could just, it was up to you. You could, it's up to you to change your life, and you could become, you know, the best person on the planet. It was all up to you, up to you. But the meaning up here. And I guess the Zen thing for me has been a huge amount of recognizing the elephant and just thinking, okay, this all this stuff is happening, and it's not up to me to give it orders and tell it to change, etc., etc. And I take comfort from that idea you said that some of us are just right brain people and some of us are left brain people. And I'm definitely one of those people who struggles like hell with everything. Mm-hmm. And you watch other people who just do this stuff like falling off a log. What's the problem? It's like, well, I can tell you the problem. It'll like tell you all about it. And I don't know if it makes sense, whether it sounds stupid, but for me, there's great comfort in, I guess it's a kind of Zen, okay, I'm that person. I'm that kind of person. And also, now I'm just going to say, well, it's the elephant. Don't just talk to the elephant, not me. So that's, I like that. That's, but does that make sense, that Zen thing of being less in control, I guess?
Right. Yeah, less with a sense of control, but still with a sense of engagement and responsibility, right? Like we still want to influence things, but in a more of a holistic kind of way. Cedar.
It just happened on a video this week, clip that I really liked, which I think speaks to the perseveration.
Mm.
And it was some kind of a neuroscience guy who suggested that journaling helps to heal or reconcile the reasoning and the emotional parts of the mind.
Yeah. Well, and that's what, I mean, I don't know a lot about cognitive therapy, but apparently that is a part of that, of, you know, training people to pay attention to where their minds are going, and then to kind of write that down, and then to kind of call that into question and start to really see that more clearly. Jeff.
Thank you. Just not to sound too pat, but I think one thing that helps me in terms of breaking out of recursive kind of things is sangha. Mm. Like just other people and recognizing, like, I mean, I get stuck in my head and interacting with other people, and, you know, being here with all of y'all, it takes me out of that. And that includes like practice things with other people, like sitting together or chanting together. But I would also say just the other aspects of our practice, like Dharma study and like chanting really, for me, it's got a meditative aspect to it that kind of takes away that controlling aspect of my mind. And that includes, like, I sometimes also chant mantra that I know are not necessarily directly related to our Zen practice, but just especially like chanting mantra together with other people or singing kirtan, like those are all ways of kind of calming the rider and bringing more of a sense of openness to the elephant, or peace with the elephant. Thank you.
I mean, you remind me, you know, in speaking of how Sangha can help, you know, positive relationships can help. Part of this research that I'm reading about with Height, you know, because it's about happiness and like all the wisdom through the ages about, you know, how to be happy. And, you know, many, you know, almost all wise people have recognized that getting more stuff does not provide lasting happiness, getting even if it's, you know, power or status or whatever. And they, you know, psychologically they've kind of described and narrowed that down to, you know, we actually get rewards, pleasurable rewards, you know, dopamine or whatever, from like taking a step closer to that goal that we have. We want to do this thing, finish this project. So we get little pleasures all the way along. And then when we get it, there's a little pleasure, but it goes away really fast. So like it's totally about the journey, right? And then like kind of once you get it, then you get tons of money. Now you just want more money, right? Like it's the movement that we respond to, not like the absolute level of whatever it is that we've attained. But one thing that he says is kind of the exception to that is human relationships, that like, you know, married people, not all married people, but a lot of times, you know, good marriages are happier. And that level of maybe your kind of general level of excitement goes down over time, but that sense of reward is renewed. It doesn't just like, oh, I got the spouse, you know, now that's done, right? Because probably because, you know, we're human beings and we're, it's always something new and alive and fresh. So I like that thought that our human relationships are like that. Paulette.
Yeah, I wanted to comment on what Mark was talking about because, yeah, I mean, I have a hard time with things too, and takes me a while to get things done and whatever. It's ongoing. But I would highly recommend the Damasio, Antonio Damasio, that you brought up, because I have to read it for my psychology classes, and it's all about making the unconscious conscious. So I don't know if anybody's interested. There's a book called Feeling and Knowing. I don't know if you can see that. But it's
can you send it to the Sangha email list too?
Yeah, sure. And it's about like making a right brain to right brain connection. So like as a just coming from the perspective of a therapist, like you get into the imagery instead of like all the cognitive like word stuff, and you can connect with people on that level. And it's definitely a different level of therapy, but it's really, I think it's very powerful. And I'm just wondering if this person who wrote the happiness hypothesis, if there's any connection between like the right brain creativity and the right brain like being more having a predilection for depression, because I could see that, how that would connect.
I absolutely don't know, and I don't even think necessary. It didn't sound like it, right?
No. Okay.
Like this, he's talking about the forehead. He's talking about like this area, like right up here. Not like I know anything, but whatever.
Instead of this. Okay. All right. Well, this is like the prefrontal cortex, so I don't know. But I don't know. It sounds a lot like this writing too. It sounds a lot like shamatha meditation too. Like the Tibetan, I don't know if anybody's ever seen that, the Tibetan map of meditation where he's riding the elephant and then the monkeys in front, and then eventually the monkeys behind him, and he's leading the monkey rather than the monkey leading him. I think you've shown it. You've shown it. I believe. No? Okay. I could put that out there too. But anyway, thank you for the talk. It's got me thinking about a lot of different things. Thank you.
Yeah. Wasn't there another hand? Oh, I don't know. Yeah. Go ahead, Ember, if you still want to.
Well, I did, but you know, there's only 3 minutes, so I'm happy to let it go, Domio. So
yeah, go for it.
Okay. Thank you for what you've shared and everybody else. And yeah, it kind of got me reflecting on, you know, I'm relatively new to Zen and, you know, I was more involved with Tibetan Buddhism. And I wondered about, you know, in Tibetan Buddhism, I remember this teaching on precious human existence and the eight freedoms and the 10 positive conditions. I wondered about that in Zen because it's a thing of like, to be just born human isn't enough to have a precious human existence. You know, there has to be other conditions there. And if I'm, you know, and it's kind of very old school, kind of medieval language, slightly like being a barbarian is not a good condition and having poor mental faculties and stuff like this, you know. But if I think about it in my context of my life, it's like, yeah, if my elephant is like really not good, you know, if I'm really distressed, you know, and I kind of think about this for myself. In my 20s, I had, you know, challenges with addiction and mental health problems, and I was engaging in Dharma, but, you know, it was hard, you know, because the elephant needed a lot of love and attention, and I needed a lot of other things. So yeah, it just reminded me about that, you know, about like precious human existence being a lot of things, you know, like it's, yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I'm not familiar with those lists, and I'd be interested because I'm guessing that it's probably going to align with what Haidt is going to talk about and prove with modern psychological research, right? Mm-hmm. At the same time, just made me think, like, okay, well, and this vision of the rider and the elephant, and we're trying to come with a better relationship, and, you know, the state of our mind and our happiness is not just dependent on, like, you know, our spiritual practice or our view, but on, you know, we're, you know, dependent, interdependent with all things. And there's also the aspect of it, which is like no rider, no elephant. All of this is just, I'm not going to say bullshit. You know, that there is a sense in which the freedom is possible regardless. You know, but it's and, right? Freedom is possible regardless. And we're affected by stuff and our makeup and our all of our elephants are different and we're limited by them, but, and we also aren't. So I could go on about that, but don't have time. So I'll just leave it there.
Thank you.
Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha.
All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita.
Thanks, Domyo.
Thank you, Domyo, and everyone.
Take care.